Let's humble our hearts before Almighty Yahweh. Almighty Yahweh, the great I Am, we come before you on your Sabbath day and we seek your will, your guidance, your understanding, and what we would study today, that what we would have presented would be from your word, and that each of us would glean something special, some more insight, and a desire to become a better witness as we go out into this world. We thank you for your blessings. We thank you for this past feast, for all those who had come and enjoyed the feast and helped in the fellowship, as well as the many other activities, that each of us would take from that a little more of your spiritual growth as we try and strive to walk in the footsteps of Yahshua the Messiah. In his name we pray, hallelujah. And you may be seated. Well, welcome everyone. You know, having to answer many questions each week, well, actually each day, generated by the TV program, gives us a chance to review what we know about certain biblical topics and Bible understanding. And we have never shied away from questions. I know there are those that tell us, you know, I tried to talk to my old minister about something, and he said, we don't take questions. We don't do that here. Yet, you know, how else are you going to learn unless you ask questions and get questions answered? In fact, one guy came to the feast. He said, well, I came here because of my understanding of the visible new moon calendar, the biblical calendar. He said, I asked my minister about it, and he said, what's a new moon? And so I guess that's one of the reasons they don't like questions to be answered. Many are engaged in a certain line of study, a certain line of understanding, and are uncomfortable going beyond that or stretching to entertain something new. If you've ever engaged someone who simply refuses to see the truth, but rather uses a variety of tactics to get out of, engagement, they'll use verbal gymnastics to try to get, you know, through the to avoid facing the facts. Even if you could always reason correctly, even if we could, you cannot be assured that others are going to do so. And that's my topic today. I want to look at how others will try to manipulate, try to bend the truth, try to get you to see through different tactics rather than just clear scripture. And I think it's important to know that because, we need to understand as we go out into the world how we may need to tailor our comments or our argument, I guess you could say, because of these things. To be able to correctly answer the errors that we find out there or to refute them, you need to understand, first of all, why they are wrong. And that means we need a good, solid understanding of the scriptures. You also need to recognize the various debate tactics. You know, Yahshua was a master of this. He almost like he relished it. He relished those opponents, those rivals of religious leaders of his, to approach him and ask him things. At least sometimes I get that impression. Always nipping at his heels, trying to catch him into something and try to, you know, discount his ministry. You recall the Pharisees in an effort to accuse Yahshua, asking him whether it was lawful to pay taxes to Caesar. It's important to appreciate the emotional trauma that pervaded this issue because the Israelites, you know, it was bad enough that they were conquered by a foreign power and then being asked to contribute money to that power was kind of like a, you know, a double sore spot with them. Public opinion kept them from laying hold of Yahshua, these religious leaders, so now they try to turn the tide against him through clever mental gymnastics, clever questions, you might say. They want to make Joshua appear to side with the Roman government against the Jews. So if he said, yes, it is lawful, then they got him. They got him siding with the hated Romans. If he said, no, it's not lawful to pay taxes to Rome, then they can go to Rome and say, look, look at this. He's teaching the people they don't have to pay taxes to you. He's an enemy of the state. Either way, they thought they got him in a pincer movement. Kind of like they did in, you know, World War II when they get someone between, you know, the two attacking sides. Well, don't ever try to back Joshua into a corner. His brilliant response deflected the challenge from himself onto Caesar. When he said, whose portrait's on the coin? Well, it's Caesar's. Caesar's portrait. Caesar Tiberius. Well, then it's his coin. Essentially, Joshua said, you recognize Caesar's civil authority when you use his coins to do business, right? Therefore, you're obliged to pay taxes to him when he asks for it. Interesting way how he took the onus away from himself and said, look, it's Caesar who wants it. Give it to Caesar. At another time, the religious leadership wanted to know why or by whom Joshua worked his miracles. See, they had heard that he said to some that he is the son of Yahweh, and they said they want to catch him on that because that was blasphemy, of course, to them. In Mark 11:27, and they came again to Jerusalem, and as he was walking in the temple, there came to him the chief priests and the scribes and the elders and said unto him, by what authority do you do these things? And who gave you this authority to do these things? And Joshua answered and said unto them, I'll ask you a question. You answer it, and I'll answer your question. And I'll tell you by what authority I do it. He says, now, the baptism of John, was this from heaven or of men? Answer me. And they reasoned with themselves, saying, well, if we say from heaven, then he's going to say, why didn't you believe him then? Right? But if we shall say of men, then they feared the people, for all men counted John a prophet. And they answered and said unto Joshua, we don't know. We don't know. See, they back them into a corner and they give up. So Joshua said, well, if you can't tell, then neither do I tell you by what authority I do these things. Joshua was very skillful at silencing his rivals. And we should also be skillful at answering objections to the truth by understanding not only their tactics, of course, but by the word. When Joshua was approached by Hasatan after his baptism, three times tempted him, he what? How did he answer? He did by the word. The word says, it, you know, this is what the word says. And of course, Satan knew what the word says. And so he just, again, relied on the ultimate authority. When children complain and ask why they have to do something, you know, the parent's typical response will be, because I said so. This rationale is known by the term bare assertion. I have the upper hand, so what I say goes. You know, no discussion. It's all about status. Now, who has the greatest status in the universe? Well, of course, Yahweh himself. The great I am. When Yahweh says, you will obey my word because I said so, there isn't a whole lot more discussion that needs to be said or done. Just accept it, okay. Well, man is not perfect like Yahweh, and neither is the church. Keep this in mind as the scene switches now to the year 1600, when a scientist named Galileo is advancing the novel theory of Copernicus that the Earth is not the center of the universe, or center of the solar system, I should say, but the sun is, and the Earth revolves around the sun. Well, this flew in the face of the Catholic Church and their doctrine. Still stinging from Luther's revolt, the church was in no mood to face some opposition from this fledgling science that was developing. Their position was the Bible is the inerrant word of Yahweh, and it contains verses showing that the earth was anchored while the sun moved. It was also the consensus that the earth was the center of Yahweh's plan. Therefore, the earth is dominant and it cannot revolve around the sun. Galileo's response was, why not? To which their answer was, because Yahweh said so. To which a serious debater and Bible student from Missouri would say, show me. Where did Yahweh say so? To which a papal commission would have retorted, why don't you try out the Iron Maiden, which is, of course, a device of torture leading to certain death. You ever look into that one? Or on a good day, they might have said, turn to Ecclesiastes 1, 4, and 5. One generation goes and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises, the sun goes down and hastens to its place where it arises. See, there's the sun moving around the earth. And 1 Chronicles 16:30, fear before him all the earth, the world also shall be stable, that it be not moved. Well, the average less than scholarly person would therefore be forever silenced, but not Galileo. He had his brand new little telescope there. And he saw differently when he looked out into the solar system, and he had lots of verification. So he was determined to refute this error. Sometimes you know something's right, you can't let it go. You just can't let it go. It's right. I know it is. I don't care how many people say it's not. Well, it came to head in 1616. Pope Paul V had a group of experts consider the basic tenets of this Copernican doctrine, this developed by the man Copernicus, and determined it was foolish and absurd, philosophically and formally heretical, inasmuch as it expressly contradicts the doctrine of Holy Scripture in many passages. In other words, the church says so, end of argument. Galileo was publicly chastised by the church and was warned to abstain altogether from teaching or defending this opinion and this doctrine, even from discussing it. Well, Galileo also believed in the inerrancy of Scripture. The problem, as he saw it, was with the way the church interpreted these passages. The way that the church put their spin on it, he didn't feel was right. The church inquisitioned him again, and this time censored and banished him. Many say this is the beginning of the strife between religion and science. Probably no better evidence for that, I guess. But there were those who even disagreed with the church at that time. The big difference was that those who didn't have the power to put an end to the argument lost. The church would win because it had the power. That's, again, bare assertion. We're right because we say we're right. And that's the way the church went on through the centuries. We're right because the church says so. It's not a good way to present a case unless you are Yahweh and infallible. Because how do you know you're right? Well, there's lots of ways, techniques that people will use. They'll use sleight of hand. They'll use twisted logic. They'll attempt to deceive you into believing false doctrine in many different ways. A logical fallacy is an error of reasoning. When someone makes an argument based on bad reasoning, we say they've committed a fallacy. Fallacious thinking keeps people from knowing the truth. And knowing the word is everything. Had the people access to it in the early years, we wouldn't see the problem we have today in churchianity. If people had access to the Bible, they would have questioned things that the church said, don't worry about it. We have the authority. Don't worry about it. Well, we've got the same problem today. People are not being taught the word, so they're getting all off into many different things. It's nothing new. When people hear an issue defended, they expect, you know what's so funny, they expect twisted logic. It's part of our culture. It's been a key part of the way people have argued for thousands of years. It's how people are typically persuaded. We're so used to it, we probably never even stop to think about it. A lot of tactics used in this kind of persuasive reasoning, but we're only going to cover a couple. Why study this twisted logic art, I guess you could say? Because we need to know what's happening. We need to know when someone approaches us with it, what the fallacy is in their argument. And when it, you know, comes to Yahweh's word, we want to make sure we have it right. A lot of times it's not based on fact, it's just a rhetorical, you know, house of cards that falls when the facts are presented. The biggest use of twisted logic is the suppressed evidence. Not telling the whole story. You ever heard of that? You know, they only tell their side. They don't tell the whole story. You leave out parts that contradict your point. We hear it all the time. Children do it all the time. When they're caught doing something we're told not to do. You know, don't jump off that cliff into the water. Well, everybody's doing it. Not telling you that last week a little boy jumped off, hit his head, and now he's paralyzed from a submerged rock. You know, that happens all the time. Most politicians love to suppress evidence. They call it looking at things positively, you know. They tell you only the parts they want you to hear and ignore the, you know, things that contradict what they're trying to prove. And, of course, TV preachers, you hear it all the time. I was listening to one recently saying that 1 Timothy 4 allows us to eat the ham sandwich. The man began by reading verse 3, forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from meats which Elohim has created to be received with thanksgiving of them which believe and know the truth. Okay? For every creature of Elohim is good and nothing to be refused if it's received with thanksgiving. Stop. And that's where he stopped. As long as you pray over it, you know, receive it with thanksgiving, pray over it, you can eat it. You can eat that grotesque lobster, that slimy shellfish full of toxic mercury and so forth. But he didn't finish the passage. The rest of it says, for it is sanctified by the word of Yahweh in prayer. He didn't tell me that it had to be set apart by Yahweh's word, Leviticus, you know, 11 and Deuteronomy 14. That's the rest of it. People are so used to hearing one-sided stories that they often won't notice anything amiss. Propagandists in World War II in Germany were some of the best in history. They said the most effective of all propaganda techniques was the one-sided story. You build up this whole case. The media use it today constantly in covering a conflict, say, between Israel and the Arabs. What do? They focus on the suffering Arabs that the, you know, the Israelis caused when they attacked. They never show what thousands of Hezbollah bombs do to Israel when they attack. They don't show that. Only one side. In religion, deceptive teachers are good at picking out and ripping out from their context only a certain side of the issue. Only the passages that they hope will support their error. Some people call this proof texting. You have a doctrine, now you go around trying to find proof for it. For example, Sunday worshipers, supporters will suppress the fourth commandment, ignore the lifelong practice of all the prophets, all the apostles, and Yahshua himself, who kept the seventh-day Sabbath, completely ignore all that. Every week of their lives, they kept the Sabbath, and focus on a few verses like 1 Corinthians 16, 1 to 2, pulling them completely out of context and say Paul advocated worship on the first day of the week. 1 Corinthians 16, 1. Now concerning this collection for the saints, as I have given order to the assemblies in Galatia, even so do ye. Upon the first day, in parentheses, of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store as Elohim has prospered, that there be no gatherings when I come. See? There it is. Offering plate at church on Sunday morning. Lay aside it, and when I come you know, to preach to you Sunday morning, there you can give me the offering plate. And when I come, whomsoever you shall approve by your letters, them will I send to bring your liberality unto Jerusalem. Oh, wait a minute. Now what's he talking about? Doesn't sound like he's going to keep it there in some kind of church setting. He says he's going to take it to Jerusalem. That's not what they tell you he's doing. For one thing, it never says Paul was going to be there the first day of the week, or even the first part of the week, to join them in worship. In fact, he says, do it on the first of the week in advance of my coming, so I don't have to sit around and wait for it. What is he talking about? To put a dollar bill on a plate? No. They had a big problem in Jerusalem. There was a famine going on because of apparent drought, and these people needed foodstuffs. They needed help. So he said, okay, I'll go to this assembly, try to get help and send it to these people. You can find that in Romans 15:26. Jerusalem was experiencing hard times. So whenever there's contradictory evidence, only slanted evidence is usually presented. This is probably the most common of the twisted logics in biblical argument. You may remember our telling of the debate that we had early on with a minister down southern Missouri. And we pointed out that from going from one language to another, names don't change. Names are transliterated, which we all know. You just take the sound from one language and you use the same sound in the other language using their alphabet that approximates the sound as close as possible. So we told him that. And, you know, explained that, you know, my name would be Alan, whether I went to China or Russia or Zimbabwe. Well, he said his name was Jeff. And when he was working as a missionary in Central America, they called him Jefe. So you see, names do change. Jefe. We learned later from Brother Jose, who speaks the language, that Jefe is just a common term meaning boss. Anybody can be a Jefe. Right, Jose? Yes, he's nodding his head. I always liked that one. We didn't know that at the time. I wish I had known that, but I'm not Spanish speaking, so. Another twisted logic technique is the hasty conclusion, which is often used today, especially on those who are not studied in the Word. You present just a little bit of evidence, then you jump to conclusions. Take the secret rapture teaching. It rests heavily on 1 Thessalonians 4, 16. For the master himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of Elohim. And the dead in Messiah shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the master in the air, and so shall we ever be with the master. See, there's the rapture. Whoa, not so fast. When does Yahshua come back? Well, 1 Corinthians 15:52 through 53 says, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump. What does that mean? At the last trump. The trumpet's going to sound, the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. Now, Revelation chapters 8 and 9 talk about the different trumpet sounds. And that's what we're talking about, the last trumpet sound. So you got, first of all, you got hail and fire mingled with blood. You got third part of the sea becomes blood at the second trumpet. Third trumpet, the part of the water becomes wormwood. Fourth trumpet, part of the sun, moon, and stars are darkened. Fifth is locusts. Sixth is warfare, with a third of mankind killed on earth. Wait a minute, I think there's people still here, because we're not to the last trumpet yet, and we've already got warfare, and a third of mankind is going to be killed. And then you have the thunders. All this time, people are still on earth. No one has lifted off into a rapture. When Yahshua returns at the trumpet sound, they say, well, before he's going to come secretly for his saints. Back to verse 16, where we find him returning with the shout, voice of an archangel, trump of Elohim. There's nothing said about a secret coming. This is the one coming that the Bible talks about. Sound like a secret scene to you? Voice of a trumpet? Earthquakes? All of this going on? Doesn't sound too secret to me. Anyway, there's no evidence anywhere that Yahshua returns twice. And the first time course, not in secret. The first time is the only time when he grabs his people, raises them up from, you know, four corners of the earth to ever be with him, whether alive or dead. And I don't know why you want to rapture dead people anyway. They don't need to be raptured. They're already dead. If that's the point, is to save them from the conflagration. Anyway, amazing how people will buy into things. The hasty conclusion, very deceptive. Very deceptive because it skips steps. It skips a lot of things if you don't understand the issue. Then there are those who, well, they just simply try to sound scholarly. That they're going to blow everybody over with their knowledge. They'll use Greek and Latin base words, you know, like apologetics, preterist, eschatological, parousia, sola scriptura, sola fide, until everybody's eyes just, ooh, this guy is a brain. How does he know all this? Whatever you say, you have so much more knowledge than I do. So you got to watch out for guys like that. Most simply don't have the specialized education or the patience to sit through the whole discourse. They're already convinced. They want a quick answer, and they don't mind if you skip, you know, a little here and there for a solution. So the hasty conclusion is most effective when the audience wants an answer. They just want it from you, and they'll believe it. Just tell me what it is, and I'll believe it. This brings to mind another tactic called the unprovable phenomena and the unknowable statistics. It's virtually impossible to prove certain things. It's impossible to prove something does not exist. Believe me, if atheists could prove that Yahweh doesn't exist, they would have done it way back in Darwin's time, I guess. But you can't prove something doesn't exist. It's like, it flies in the face of simple logic. It's like a missing link for the theory of evolution. The evolutionists would say it just hasn't been discovered yet. That's how they go about it. All the evidence points to one, but it'll be found one day. So the theory is based on faith. It's just another faith. Evolution is just another religion because it's all based on faith, basically. They don't know where everything started from, how it got there. It just started. You know, big old soup and lightning, and here comes a cell. Somehow that cell, by itself, without any direction, started developing into complex organisms. It's all faith. It's all ridiculous. By the same token, neither can anyone prove that Yahweh does not exist. In fact, you look at creation, you say, I think he exists. Look at how complex it is. I can't even understand it, and I got a brain. No one can understand it, and they all have brains. They can't even understand how they got there. You'd think they'd even know that if they have, you know, brains to figure it out. You got to weigh evidence. You got to think of yourself in a courtroom. I think a brother here talked about that one time. He said, I wish I could just put these truths up in a courtroom and debate it out and see where we end up, you know, logically, systematically, methodically. One guy gives his, another one gives his truth, and see where it leads. So you have to learn how to weigh evidence. I remember the Da Vinci Code a few years back, where author Dan Brown writes that 80 other gospels competed for inclusion in the New Testament. 80? Are you kidding me? Where did he come up with that? 80 other non-inspired books of the New Testament? I don't see how I can prove that statistic. So let's say we go with it. How many of these competing gospels, you could say, talk about JC marrying someone? None. Even the Gnostic gospel of Mary Magdalene says nothing about Yahshua marrying her, only that he was a companion. Remember, this is Gnostic. This is false, or there's something wrong with it. It doesn't stand up to the rigors of, the tests of truth. So they didn't put it in the scriptures, the gospel of Mary Magdalene. The only one that comes close to linking Yahshua and Mary is the Gnostic gospel of Philip. And that came along 180 to 250 years after the event. And there again, it talks about a companion. And that word can mean anything. You know, doesn't mean you're married. Well, you've got all sorts of evidence that shows Yahshua was not married in the Word. You got Josephus supporting that. He was a historian that lived back in that time, a priest and historian. That Yahshua was celibate, didn't have a special relationship with Mary Magdalene. He died and was raised. So how would the court rule? How would the court, giving this evidence, rule in this case? It wouldn't even be a contest. Guilty of unprovable and unknowable statistics. And yet you still have this idea from some that Yahshua was married while he walked this earth. Then there's another device called the red herring. I really like this one. In a red herring argument, you intentionally digress from the real issue being discussed. You introduce a side issue to kind of throw everything off, you see. It's an attempt to deflect attention away from the real matter at hand. Call it changing the subject. I remember growing up when I was approached by my dad, and something I had done. He started asking me questions, and I would start trying to change the subject because I was guilty, you know. That's what people will do. They'll try to change the subject, deflect attention away from the real matter. The red herring. It's often done, and the new issue can often seem closely related to the actual issue, but it's not. You've seen it. You engage someone about the truth of the Sabbath, okay? What do they say? Oh, I keep every day holy. That's not the issue. What is the Sabbath? That's not even entering the argument. I mean, that has nothing to do. It's not germane to the point. What you do is not the issue. I'm sorry. Yahweh made the Sabbath to keep it holy. Not just any day, and certainly not every day. The seventh day, he said, work 7 days and rest the seventh, according to the fourth commandment. Take another red herring. You show that his name is Yahweh, but he has many names. That's what they'll say. Even though that's contradicted by abundant evidence of passages saying he has one name, but that's not the point. His name is Yahweh. Okay, so let's go with their argument anyway. He has many names. Show me book, chapter, and verse that says he has many names. Not going to find it. His name alone is said to be Yahweh. Psalm 83:18. Clearly, by the way, that's the Tetragrammaton. One of three places in the King James where the name is an attempted transliteration in large capitals. The others are Exodus 6:3 and Isaiah 26:4. So that's the red herring. Then there's guilt by association. It's used when you can't disprove a point, so you attack the person making the point with an extreme comparison or something very distasteful. It was used against Paul when they couldn't answer him. They couldn't understand his teachings, and they just, oh, this guy's a nut. His ministry is, he's just a sect. We know it by other terms today. Nothing to do with the legitimacy of his argument. Another popular maneuver is the false comparison or false motive. This is a popular ploy with the grace alone crap. You explain that Yahweh expects obedience from his people all the way through the scripture, Genesis through Revelation, and their response is, what, are you trying to earn your salvation? What's that got to do with it? No, obedience has nothing to do with earning anything. I'm just wanting to honor the one I serve and be worthy of his being called his. You know? They immediately jump to a conclusion that you know, you're trying to be better than everybody else. You're trying to earn your salvation. You know, we sometimes have that accusation thrown at us. And, you know, the response is, well, obeying the law is not going to qualify anyone for the kingdom. But I'll tell you what, breaking it will certainly keep you out of it. He's not going to save a law-breaking sinner, no matter how much he loves the lard, as they say. The proof is in the pudding. until that person repents, of course. Luke, this is how Yahshua put it in Luke 20, verse 35. But they which shall be accounted worthy to obtain that world and the resurrection from the dead, neither marry nor are given in marriage. So he talks about being worthy for it. Paul writes, 1 Thessalonians 2:12, that you be that you would walk worthy of Elohim, who has called you unto his kingdom and glory. Related to the false comparison is the straw man. It's like evidence turned around backwards, or maybe inside out. You build a straw man when you misrepresent your opponent's position by adding some critical flaws to what he's presenting, you see. That's kind of like what we just talked about. Oh, you're trying to earn your salvation. That's not what I'm even talking about. But that's the straw man. It's a tool of a big tool in a politician's bag of tricks. You add critical flaws to his argument. Advertising is full of it. It's so full of it, we expect it when you see an advertisement. No one thinks a TV commercial is going to tell the truth about the other product. They'll just tell you how great their product is and paint the other product as bad or inferior. It could be superior in many ways, or maybe even all superior, but they're not going to tell you that. Or you hear maybe a cleric say, so you mean that along with the commandments and feasts, I need to bring a bull to sacrifice when I worship on the Sabbath? What? Whoever said anything about a bull? Whoever said about anything about a blood sacrifice, animal blood sacrifice? Did I say that? We had that leveled at us, one of our first feasts. People at the campground were another denomination, and we inquired about something. They said, oh, you're going to sacrifice goats too? I don't know. That's kind of a mean thing to say, but you'll hear people say it. Or, well, you mean, so I need to keep all 612 other laws? Well, first of all, I never said there were 613 laws. That's something some Jew came up with. Like, that could be easily debated. And I never said I was trying to keep all of them. For instance, if I go out, you know, and suffer not a witch to live, I'd be hanging from the gallows myself. That wasn't the point of that law. The point of that law was a governmental law given to Israel for civil authorities because they were under a theocracy, you see. Yahweh mandated these things because this is how his word spoke. It's not something I have the prerogative to do. Others are unique to Israel's state religion, which, of course, has been usurped by our system now. We have no power in this government to do these things. So no, we can't keep all of these laws, and we're not intended to. There's certain meaning and certain reasons for them that we can't go that way. Not yet. When Yahshua comes back, he's going to make these things all, I believe. You know, Deuteronomy is going to be probably the Constitution, and then these things will be done. But we can't go out and punish people, transgressors. Yahweh gave to the people a theocracy guided by him, and that's why he gave these laws. You know, it's mandated by him as head of the government. For the guy who is listening to the bait, the straw man can be a powerful influence if he's not perceptive enough to see what's happening, to see how deceptive it really is. Then there's the ad populum. What is that? That just appeal to popularity. The truth of an issue is established merely on the basis of it's more popular, it's more familiar. You can look up some of these Bibles. I've forgotten which one it was, but in the foreword it says, we would have used Yahweh's name had this Bible been written for those students, deep students of the scriptures. But because of people's familiarity with the titles, we went with the titles. Is that a reason to cover up truth? Advertisers use it a lot. Buy our detergent. It's preferred 2-to-1 by women who know. Who are these women? How do they know? Did they do a double blind test or what? What was it? No, I think it was some copywriter sitting back on his computer and just making things up. That sounds good. Let's say that. So people believe it. Or a survey says, show 82% of Americans believe in a Trinity. Therefore, it's got to be right. My uncle said he joined the largest church because it was the largest. Therefore, it must have the truth. Never mind, the scripture says just the opposite. He never considered that maybe Yahshua was teaching something key when he warned against massive deception out there in the world of religion. Or the fact that Yahshua and his disciples and their new covenant faith were themselves outnumbered by the religious establishment, thousands to one. I guess he never thought about Yahshua as saying in Luke 12:32, "Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." So where does that leave the large flock? Does it make you want to be in the large flock? Historically, the great majority has nearly always been in the wrong. You know, it's just the way it is. The big lie is a technique that propagandists use with lots of success. The big lie. The idea is a technique that you just keep repeating the same lie over and over and over, and pretty soon something's going to sink in until people embrace it. And massive repetition is essential. I remember certain advertisements growing up. They played them for years on TV, commercials. I got so sick of them. But it must have worked because they used them over and over and over, and they're paying big bucks to say that. People seem to, you know, migrate that way. Just repeating the same over and over in spite of the arguments or evidence to the contrary, and a certain percentage will accept it. Even Hitler in his book explained the big lie technique. Of course, we know he was great at that. He said, the greatness of the lie is always a certain factor in being believed. At the bottom of their hearts, the great masses of people are more likely to be misled than be consciously and deliberately bad. And in the primitive simplicity of their minds, wow, they are more easily victimized by a large rather than a small lie. Some part of even the boldest lie is sure to stick. Wow, isn't that interesting? It's a peculiar fact that giant, totally outrageous lies are sometimes more believable than small lies, just by virtue of their bodaciousness, you know. How can that be so? People fear that there must be something to it, or people wouldn't be saying it or promoting it, because the claims are so extreme. I guess they're saying, well, there's too much smoke. There's got to be fire somewhere. Then there's the technique of obtuseness. Refuse to follow the argument. Just close your mind. When all else fails, just stubbornly refuse to see your opponent's points, no matter how good his arguments may be. When a opponent makes a point, just ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist, or you didn't hear it, or, you know, do not in any way recognize that it even exists. Or just say, I don't know about that. We've all encountered that, I'm sure. I did, trying to explain the necessity of the feast days to a friend. He refused even to look at it. His eyes just glazed over. And he shut the argument down, shut the conversation down, and shut down his own reasoning mechanism. And I was left there standing there like talking to a droid or something. He just didn't connect at all. He refused. Then he walked away. In John 8, we find that Yahshua had the same problem as we do sometimes in showing others the truth who just don't want to see it. It can be frustrating. But then it helps us to know that, you know, we're not alone in this universe. Even Yahshua faced these same problems, and he got through it. And because I tell you the truth, he said, you believe me not. Which of you convinces me of sin? And if I say the truth, why do you not believe me? He that is of Yahweh hears Yahweh's words. You therefore hear them not, because you are not of Yahweh. So understand, the people that close their minds just simply aren't being called at this time. Whether they will be in the future, we don't know. But, you know, don't get upset. Just say, okay, The seed didn't take sprout there, so I move on. Well, I hope the next time someone tries to pull the wool over your eyes, you have a little better insight into some of these machinations that people use, and you can call them at their game. You know, the best thing to do is have a good, solid understanding of the word. So when you hear it, oh, that doesn't ring true. That can't be right. You go back and, yep, that's right. It does not square with the scriptures. Yahweh's word is a powerful sword, and it doesn't need trickery. It doesn't need any gimmicks. Just plain understanding through the pure word as it's presented. Don't need propaganda. It stands on its own, and we can be certain of the truth if we just stand on the word. And may Yahweh bless you.